Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We're up for the final session of this year's summer school, the last time over the top for the final push. I hope you're all suitably energetic and ready. So far this weekend, we've had the greatest slaughter in world history. We've had the bright lights of a revolution, and we've had the possible coming of the killer robots to destroy us all. So to end on a cheery note, we're going to have Mike Foster talking about living under the threat of nuclear annihilation.
Perfect subject matter for a Sunday morning when we're either tired or hungover or both. One of the earlier talks this weekend emphasised the importance of, I'll try and remember the word, was it a structural analysis of capitalism, and also avoiding being selective about the evidence. This is the counter-argument to that, so there'll be lots of subjective comments I'll be giving. So obviously it's the way I've presented it, it's quite a subjective matter, so obviously in the discussion hopefully people will chip in with their own subjective viewpoints. And as for the whole structured analysis thing, there's a little bit of that crammed in towards the end, but mostly not. So I won't be talking much about the economic and political history of the Cold War. Instead, I'll be focusing on one way in which it was fought, and that was ideologically. Wars are only possible if there's a perceived difference between two countries or cultures. And it is the perceived differences between the people living on either side of the Iron Curtain which I'll be discussing. So I'll be looking at the extent to which states and the media influence perceptions of people in their own country and also people on the other side, and how successful these attempts were, especially among younger people from the sort of mid-1960s onwards. So I won't be discussing sort of McCarthyism, for example. My period will be sort of the last few decades of the Cold War. But to give a bit of background, during the Second World War, the propaganda produced by both sides had included stereotypes of different groups of people. The Nazi authorities in Germany depicted the Jews as a lesser race, and while Allied films and posters about the Japanese presented them as brainwashed killers. Supposedly positive stereotypes are also promoted within the own country and also to people abroad, such as the mythical Aryan race in Germany, the all-American family living the American dream, and the stoic new Soviet man and woman. By the end of the Second World War, the political and social map of Europe had changed. States were competing to recover from the war and improve their economic standing. The start of the Cold War signalled another shift in European politics, with relationships between the West and the East changing significantly. States needed to reassert themselves, and this meant encouraging particular perceptions of themselves and other countries. Some of the older stereotypes were still relevant, such as the all-American family and the new Soviet person. But now that relations between East and West had changed, how were Russians thought of by Americans and Brits? And what did Russians think about Westerners? I'll mostly be talking about Britain, America, America to a lesser extent, and Russia, rather than East Germany or anywhere else affected by the Cold War. That's just for reasons of time, as much as anything. So I'll start off by talking about the West. In the West, the most emotive aspect of the Cold War is its association with the threat of nuclear war. From the 1950s, the governments of Britain and America produced civil defence information about how the public could apparently prepare for a nuclear blast. Several short films and booklets were produced and updated when new research came to light, although some guidance remained constant into the 1980s. For example, we were given the valuable advice that it's best to avoid looking directly at a nuclear explosion, you know, just in case anyone wasn't sure about that. And if you're caught out in the open when the bomb drops, then you can get some protection by lying on the ground. You know, never would have thought of that. The American Duck and Cover campaign from 1951, which is a bit earlier than the bulk of what I'll be talking about. So the Duck and Cover campaign was aimed at school children and turtles, presumably, as we'll find out in this short clip.
And
He did what we all must learn to do. You and you and you and you.
Be sure to remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. That's what this film is all about. Duck and cover.
Right. I'm not sure if the American military actually issued turtle shells for people to hide inside. I haven't found that in my research. So that's how to survive a nuclear war. Right. The term duck and cover lives on as the name of a clothing brand, apparently. Another film, The House in the Middle, from 1954, again, it's an American one, suggested that keeping your home and garden neat and tidy could save your life after the bomb drops by reducing the amount of combustible material. The 1960s and the 1970s became known as the détente period, when the Cold War had thawed a little and there were slightly fewer tensions between the East and West. The situation was still quite bleak during the détente, as shown not only by the growing criticisms made by CND and other groups, but also in official announcements. In Britain, 1963 saw the publication of the pamphlet advising the householder on protection against nuclear attack, which, like the American campaigns, was based on guidance given during the Second World War. During the 1970s, the government revised this again as the Protect and Survive campaign, which was launched in 1980, but based on research and amendments throughout the 1970s. This leaflet, that's the cover, gave information about warning sirens, converting part of your house into a bomb shelter, the risks of radioactive fallout, stockpiling food, and managing after the blast. The campaign included 20 short films, which would be broadcast on television if a nuclear war seemed imminent. So although they were never shown, the content is very similar to the published pamphlet. Here's the last film in the series. There's nothing graphic in it. There's nothing graphic in it, as I say, but it's one of the creepiest things I've ever seen.
After an attack is over and the all clear has been sounded, arrangements will be made as soon as possible to treat any people who are ill or injured. Listen to your radio. Details will be given about what to do, when to do it, and how. If anyone dies while you are kept in your fallout room, move the body to another room in the house. Label the body with name and address, and cover it as tightly as possible in polythene, paper, sheets, or blankets. Tie a second card to the covering. The radio will advise you what to do about taking the body away for burial. If, however, you have had a body in the house for more than 5 days, and if it is safe to go outside, then you should bury the body for the time being in a trench or cover it with earth and mark the spot of the burial.
What wasn't that reassuring? I was born in 1975, so my memories of the Cold War start from around the time the Protect and Survive leaflet came out. In the early 1980s, fears about nuclear war were at their height. The jingoism and nationalism of earlier official campaigns, especially the American ones, was replaced by bleak pessimism. It's hard now to empathise with the dread of a nuclear holocaust that coloured life around this time, even with current concerns about war. When I was 13 or 14, I remember sitting in class at school when the teacher wheeled in the clumsy trolley with the television and top-loading Betamax video player. Although this usually meant that the teacher hadn't bothered to prepare a proper lesson, it didn't always mean that we'd be watching something entertaining. Often we'd be shown a gruesome public information film. And on this occasion, we were treated to the 1982 BBC documentary, A Guide to Armageddon. This described the destruction and injuries that would be caused by a nuclear bomb exploding above London, and no doubt partly based on what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Images of the film are still engraved on my memory. I remember blast damage being depicted by a slow motion shot of what happens to a joint of meat next to an exploding window, and the makeup department must have used up all their supplies of red and purple paint on a woman shown at the various stages of radiation sickness. After our trauma had subsided, the class was split into groups, and each of us had to come up with a short play about nuclear war. And I think my group, and probably most of the other groups, channeled our teen angst into something bleak and depressing. So our teachers either had a morbid streak, or they sincerely wanted to raise our awareness of the threat of nuclear war. A few years earlier, in 1984, I was too terrified to watch all of the BBC's docudrama Threads, which dramatised the short and long-term consequences of a nuclear bomb being dropped on Sheffield. It was commissioned by the BBC's Director-General at the time as an update of the 1965 drama, docudrama The War Game, which was banned because of its upsetting content. Threads was advertised on the cover of that week's Radio Times with a rather cheerful shot of a traffic warden holding a shotgun. Over in America, the television film The Day After covered similar territory to Threads, although it's slightly less shocking. This was watched by over 100 million people on its initial broadcast, including Ronald Reagan, who apparently was slightly less belligerent in his dealings with the Soviet Union as a result. A popular book in the school library was the graphic novel When the Wind Blows, produced by Raymond Briggs, who at the time was best known for cartoon Fungus the Bogeyman. When the Wind Blows, which was also later adapted into an animated film and I think a stage show as well, follows a middle-aged couple who tried to follow the official government advice about trying to protect yourself from a nuclear bomb. And it's not much of a spoiler to say that it doesn't have a happy ending. Of course, the main threat of nuclear war came from the Russian authorities rather than the general public in Russia. However, perceptions of Russians in general reflected our fears of their military and governments. In 1966, a public opinion survey was carried out in America to gauge views about Russian people. Among the top five adjectives used to describe Russians were warlike and treacherous. But it's not that Russians were only portrayed as warlike, they were also perceived as backward. I remember some playground talk about how Russians were apparently so dim-witted that they had only discovered toast in the 1970s, which we really believed. Until the Glasnost and Perestroika initiatives in the later 1980s, the Soviet Union seemed more alien than the planets featured on Doctor Who. Another example of the strange way in which Russians were perceived can be found in the rather patronising and pretentious single Russians by Sting, which almost reached the top 10 in 1985. It featured the lyrics, "Believe me when I say to you, I hope the Russians love their children too," as if there was any doubt that they would. Nuclear war was a popular subject for many pop and rock artists, including OMD, Kate Bush, various heavy metal bands, and especially Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And their video for the song Two Tribes features lookalikes of Reagan and Chernenko wrestling. And the song also used extracts from the planned Protect and Survive broadcasts, re-recorded by their original narrator. Stereotypical and insulting views of Russians were the norm in America, as shown by this advert. I won't tell you what it's advertising, see if you can guess. And apologies for the poor quality in more ways than one. So, technical hitch. I think that's from around about 1985. According to American professors Jerome Frank and Andre Melville, stereotypes of Russians, and the same also applies to Russian stereotypes of Westerners, and this is a quote, stereotypes act like distorting lenses that magnify confirming information and filter out incompatible information. This, in turn, increases the likelihood of serious misunderstandings of the enemy's intentions. Thus, the mass media in both the USSR and the US often play up incidents which were regarded as manifestations of the other's treachery or cruelty and tended to ignore examples of humanitarian or honourable behaviour. Similarly, the same behaviour is often seen in the service of good motives if performed by one side and in the service of bad motives if performed by the other side. For example, although in wartime both sides always commit atrocities, the enemy's atrocities are evidence of his evil nature, whereas ours are portrayed as regrettable necessities. That's the end of the quote. In other words, negative stereotypes of the other group encourage us to interpret their behaviour as hostile and ours as reasonable. Of course, at the time, we were reminded that the Russians aren't really all that different from us by people like defecting ballet dancer Rudolf Nureyev, who famously pirouetted with Miss Piggy. Even Chekhov in Star Trek or the hit computer game Tetris, which was leaked to the West from Russia in the mid-80s, counters positive representations of Russia in the West. Later, you know, to give him his credit, Mikhail Gorbachev seemed a bit more amiable and human than Ronald Reagan and certainly Margaret Thatcher. At the time, all this was seen through the eyes of a teenager, though, and I was still more concerned with surviving PE lessons than surviving a nuclear war. I was even less interested at the time in understanding the economic and political consequences or causes of the Cold War. I remember being confused about something I heard about called the Warsaw Pact, which was often mentioned in the news. I hadn't heard of Warsaw, but I had heard of Walsall, and I wasn't quite sure why a small patch of the Black Country had such significance in the heart of international politics. The fear of a nuclear holocaust can now almost be looked on with nostalgia, hence marketing T-shirts. But at the time it was widespread, especially among younger people. Between 1978 and 1980, JMAC and W. Beardsley surveyed just over 1,000 American secondary school students, and they concluded, quote, "The questionnaire showed that these adolescents are deeply disturbed by the threat of nuclear war, have doubt about the future and about their own survival. There is also cynicism, sadness, bitterness and a sense of helplessness. They feel unprotected. Some have doubts about planning families or are unable to think ahead in any long-term sense." The fears about nuclear war in the West didn't only come from the state, but also from the media and pressure groups like CND. And in part, our fear was tied to the belief that Russians were different enough from us in order not to care about dropping the bomb on us. That was the perception. And in the popular mindset, this applied to Russian citizens as much as it did to the government in Russia and the military. But how does this view compare with what Russians were really like? Of course, that's a generalisation over such a wide area, but that's unfortunately what we'll have to deal with. Obviously, it's difficult to sort of sum up a whole culture in a few paragraphs. And also, were there equivalent beliefs and perceptions in Russia at the time? Were Westerners demonised in Russia in the same way that Russians were demonised in the West? At the start of the Cold War, there was little official objection to Russians following trends in Western culture, as long as they were appreciated for their aesthetic and technical features rather than the country in which they came from. One aspect of Western culture which was particularly popular from the 1950s was jazz and rock and roll music. Interest and demand increased faster than the records could be copied and distributed by black marketers and friends. So there was a lot of copying of vinyl records going on at the time. And a slight digression, but vinyl records were copied using two turntables synced up with one another. The source disc was played on one turntable with its output set to control the movements of a heated sapphire needle. And this cut the grooves into a blank disc placed on the second turntable. However, at that time, getting hold of blank discs to record Western music onto was quite difficult. In the late 1950s, a solution was found in an unlikely place, hospitals. Discarded X-ray plates were found to be suitable for copying Western records onto once they had been cut to the correct size and shape. And that's an example of a record. That's the hole in the middle, that's the grooves, and you can make out that that's a reused X-ray plate of someone's chest. Both Western-style capitalism and Soviet state capitalism went through periods of economic growth during the 1960s, with a decline during the 1970s. This time in Russian history has become known as the Brezhnev era, named after the leader Leonid Brezhnev. During this era, Soviet culture was characterised by conformity alongside increased scrutiny of private life. This means that Western influences were now more deliberately countered by the Soviet state, and Soviet officials called the fascination of Western culture Western idolatry. throughout this time, Western music continued to be popular in Russia, especially among younger people. They didn't necessarily understand the lyrics. To them, Western music represented excitement and energy, much the same as it represented to people in the West. The Ukrainian Communist Party's youth wing, Komsomol, drew up a list of Western music artists whose works were not recommended because they contained, quote, ideological harmful compositions. And here's a translation of a document circulated around around the time. See if your favourite artists are on there. My favourite, Sparks, or one of my favourites, is on there. But they didn't have much favour in Russia along with the other ones. So a couple of ones worth pointing out. Pink Floyd weren't recommended because of interfering in the foreign policy of the USSR in Afghanistan. And I think that's a quote to a couple of lines of their LP, The Final Cut, which I think comes from 1983. In Afghanistan, Talking Heads weren't recommended for perpetuating the myth of Soviet military danger. Tina Turner wasn't recommended for sex. And Julio Iglesias for neo-fascism. So next time you put on a Julio Iglesias record, he's a neo-fascist, according to Russia. Lists like this weren't always adhered to, and Western music often appeared on state radio, surprisingly. Western music was, for some, a temporary escape from the bleakness and paucity of much of Soviet life. And some Russian humour from the time suggested a grudging acceptance of the West having better standards of living. For example, there's quite a few collections of Russian humour. I mean, this one, the title alone is worth the money, Hammer and Tickle. so there's been quite a lot of analysis of Russian humour during the Cold War and what kinds of messages it tells us about Russian culture. And there's a joke about the Soviet architect who was on a trip abroad, a foreign architect, as in foreign to the Soviets, so American, European, whoever. A foreign architect invited him into his home and showed his Russian guest around. "This is my hall," he explained, "and this is a sitting room, this is my study, those are the children's bedrooms, this is the main bedroom, and this is the spare room for visitors. Then there are the kitchen, the dining room, the two bathrooms and the lavatory." "It's a very good layout," says the Soviet guest. And then the guest is asked, "What sort of layouts do you have?" And he replies, "Us? Well, we have much the same, only without partitions." And humour which poked fun at life in the Soviet Union could also be found in more official places, perhaps surprisingly. And there's a film called The Irony of Fate, or Enjoy Your Bath, which was a comedy film first shown on Russian television in 1976. Its protagonist, a man called Zenya, gets drunk with a group of friends in Moscow. Mistakenly, because he's still drunk, he gets on a plane to Leningrad and tries to find his way home, unaware that he's in the wrong city entirely. Both Moscow and Leningrad have been built up with identical-looking streets and tower blocks, even down to having the same street names. And this uniformity extends to doors having the same locks, so when Zenya finds what he thinks is his flat, he can let himself in. The other flat is even furnished like his own one, the only difference being that its tenant is a young woman called Nadja, you know, with hilarious consequences. The film is live action, it's acted, but it's got a short animated introduction, which I'll show. And, I think this depicts, so it's a Russian architect, you know, quite proud of the nice building his design. So he goes out, you know, to get approval. But, you know, the first person who approves it or looks at it doesn't like some of the features. So he goes somewhere else. The next person doesn't like a few more of the features, so he goes along. So, the end of that film sort of showed the whole world being ruined with the same kind of drab grey tower blocks that were commonplace in Russia. The film was massively popular in the Soviet Union and has been, I think, repeated near enough every year since 1976. And by 1978, so only 2 years after it was first broadcast, an estimated 250 million people had seen the film. And a sequel featuring the same cast was made in 2007. There have been several books written about Russian humour during the Cold War, as I've suggested, as it can reveal beliefs more accurately than state propaganda can. jokes were also probably a better gauge of popular feeling than samizdat, or if that's how you say it, or underground literature produced in Russia. Most dissident writings had fairly small circulations of around 200,000 readers on average. Many of these readers had some cultural power and authority, including censors who read the literature in order to know what they were going to censor. The cost of buying samizdat literature was often too high for the majority of people in Russia, who tended to prioritise their spending on necessities. So in the 60s, 70s and 80s, the usual official message was that Western trends tempt people, especially teenagers, into indolent lifestyles. And there are several examples in the state-run satirical magazine Crocodile, I should say, including this one. So there, you know, you've got a Western denim, yeah, fashion, you know, that's using obviously religious images. So you've got the snake tempting Adam and Eve, or Adamski and Evesky, into an indolent lifestyle. However, Russian youth didn't recognise themselves so much in this kind of cartoon. For them, appreciating Western trends didn't conflict with Soviet ideology, which they interpreted as a desire to learn and to be creative. So there was a bit of doublethink potentially going on there. The trends introduced to Russia during the more open 1950s weren't just going to go away because of increased state repression during and after the 1960s. And the state itself was hypocritical in also allowing trade in Western goods. One example is the chain of Berioska. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly. Berioska stores, which sold imports of Western commodities like cars, clothes, cosmetics, televisions, fridges and other furniture. These shops only accepted foreign money, which I think was, you had to use foreign money to buy some sort of credit note or something, and then you'd spend the credit note in the shop, so you couldn't spend Russian money directly in them. So because these shops only accepted foreign money, they were most popular with relatively well-off Russian diplomats and businessmen working outside the country. Those wealthy enough to afford to shop at Berioska avoided the waiting lists for these kind of goods when sold through the state. And there's anecdotal evidence that poorer people often bought money redeemable at Berioska on the black market, just so they'd be sort of justified in entering these shops to have a look round. And these shops were regarded by many with something like awe. One shopper said, "My first trip to Berioska made a strong impression on me. Everything looked so good, so necessary, so nice. And then there was the store's atmosphere. There was nobody around and the salespeople were much more polite than usual. It was a completely different form of customer service." Other people were resentful that Berioska shops were only accessible to the rich, and pointed out the similarity with the word I can't pronounce, Raspredilyauti, I think, which were exclusive shops only open to state officials. By the late 1980s, criticism of the Berioska shops was more open, and they became obsolete after the rules on exchanging foreign currencies were relaxed. So, in Russia, Western culture was often perceived as something to aspire to, and this meant that Western people were looked up to as exciting trendsetters. And this belief wouldn't have been popular if Russian people were really as different and as drab as we were led to believe in the West, or if they had been successfully conditioned by the state. Soviet propaganda often included details of free market capitalism's failings. Unfortunately, though, many Russians didn't believe these criticisms because they thought it was state lies. Now, I'm not arguing that any of this makes Western culture something to aspire to, or that it makes the Soviet system any less repellent. My point is that the Soviet state was less harsh than Western states in its depiction of people living under the other variant of capitalism. These trends in Soviet thought were echoed in Russian people's views on the threat of nuclear war. Two psychologists, Stanislav K. Roskin and Tatiana S. Kabachenko, carried out research into beliefs about nuclear war during the mid-1980s. They surveyed over 900 Russian high school and college students, mostly aged between 16 and 22. 40% of students thought that nuclear war was likely to happen, while 60% didn't. Compared with the American survey I mentioned earlier, there was generally less fear in Russia of the Cold War turning into a nuclear holocaust than there was in the West, although it was still a significant concern. And as to the consequences of nuclear war, nearly all Russian students believe that if it happened, most of the world's population wouldn't survive. Predictably, people thought nuclear war was most likely when relationships between the two sides were at a low ebb. However, pessimism about nuclear war depended to some extent on how the political system was how the political situation was reported. It's tempting to assume that the relatively less pervasive fear of nuclear war in Russia may be partly due to less information being available than in the West. However, this isn't necessarily the case. The American nuclear holocaust drama The Day After was broadcast on state television in 1987 in Russia, surprisingly. And a compulsory module in Russian schools was civil defence, which included information about preparing for a nuclear war. A 19-year-old in 1983 sarcastically wrote in her diary, quote, "Civil defence is a great subject. My textbook has wonderful illustrations of how citizens behave in the case of a nuclear war. For example, tidy, attractive citizens who unanimously follow the codex of the builder of communism peacefully enter a fallout shelter. A phlegmatic young man, with blood gushing from his body like a fountain, stands next to a confident and skillful nurse. And there are other realistic pictures in which no one shows any signs of panic." I haven't been able to find the pictures used in that textbook, but I suspect they combined the so-called socialist realist style of drawings with the similar misinformation to that found in Western civil defence instructions. So we've seen that the West popularised a perception of Russians as a different breed of people, dehumanised by the Soviet system. We might assume that there was a similar approach taken behind the Iron Curtain, a perception of Westerners as corrupted and cheapened by the free market. In fact, it was Westerners who were conditioned more successfully by their states. People in Russia tended to have a more accepting outlook of Westerners, despite what the state-run media told them, and despite what the Western media told us about what Russians were like. So, what values did the Russian authorities want to instill in their population? In 1963, the 24th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union finalised a definition of the Soviet people. This single all-Soviet entity was attributed many of the characteristics that official doctrine had previously ascribed to geographical areas of the USSR. The Soviet people were said to be, quote, "a new historical, social and international community of people having a common territory, economy and socialist content, a culture that reflected the particularities of multiple nationalities, a federal state and a common ultimate goal, the construction of communism." Since the Stalinist era, the Soviet authorities had promoted the archetype of what they believed a Soviet person should be like. The new Soviet man and new Soviet woman were the intended products of state capitalism. They would be selfless, educated, healthy, and enthusiastic about the Soviet regime. And among younger people, these values were promoted by the official youth organisations. These were sections of the All-Union Leninist Young Communist League, or Komsomol, which was the youth division of the Communist Party. Members took part in lectures, activities and meetings aimed at instilling values like study, hard work, cooperation and innovation, supposedly. These traits were intended to improve the running of educational establishments, workplaces and society as a whole, and therefore they were rather blunt and clumsy tools of state indoctrination. However, the values they taught were also applicable and could be reused to life outside what was officially sanctioned, as shown by the making of records on X-ray plates, as I showed earlier. Those who didn't join the official youth organisations found their prospects in higher education and therefore employment limited. So how widely shared were these official values? Or in other words, how sort of successful, if you like, was the state in trying to drum into people their archetype of the perfect person? A survey carried out in Russia in 1989 asked what qualities are most characteristic of Russians. Only 27% thought that loving work was a Russian characteristic, and only 2% thought that being active was one. The most widespread traits were being open-hearted at 60% and being hospitable at 55%. So the survey concluded that an average Russian looks at himself or herself as lazy, passive, dependent on circumstances, though rather good-natured in human relations, and above all, stuck to an old principle of patience. The same point was made by the Russian writer Alexander Zinoviev. His 1982 sociological work was entitled Homo Sovieticus, a term he invented to describe the Soviet character as he saw it. He said that the typical Russian was characterised by indifference at work, lack of initiative, fascination with Western culture, and acceptance of state propaganda. He argued that these traits had been the result of Soviet policies being implemented in the wrong way, as he saw it, and as a betrayal of the ideal of the new Soviet person. So his perspective was a more conservative one. He was coming from that angle. So there was less acceptance of the state's methods than we might suppose. Letters from the time show that people often avoided official meetings or just went through the motions when attending them, without really being enthusiastic about all the policies and procedures. And this can be compared with those of us in free market capitalist countries who just go through the motions of boring, unfulfilling jobs without really believing in or thinking about the wider economic system. Russians also had more awareness of workers' struggles in the West than we might assume. Russian miners donated a day's pay to striking British miners in the mid-1980s, although they were later told that Margaret Thatcher had blocked the money from being received. So, as we've seen, life in Cold War Russia didn't really turn people into the supposed ideal of the new Soviet man or woman, and nor was the dull alien stereotype we were used to in the West accurate. Propaganda from either side of the Iron Curtain gave a distorted view of the so-called enemy culture. So to sum up, capitalist ideology influenced people in both the West and the USSR. It was just expressed in different ways. Capitalism, as we know, divides up the world into countries, each one with a state competing for influence in the wider economic market. The state capitalist countries of the East shared the same fundamental features as the free market capitalist countries in the West. In both variations of capitalism, the means of production, and therefore political and economic power, are owned by a minority of people. In state capitalist countries, the state is the main capitalist power, whereas in free market countries, this is divided between the state and private corporations. So this means that the working class in America, Russia at the time, and now, the UK, Germany, or any other country, are all living in a similar economic system of exploitation. Socialists argue that the perceived differences between people in other countries are a product of capitalist principles, especially nationalism, the belief that we have a loyalty to the country that we just happen to have been born or brought up in. Capitalism needs nationalism in order to persist, especially when countries are at war with each other. During the Cold War, each side promoted nationalism by exaggerating and distorting the differences between Russians and Westerners. Workers on both sides were subject to fear, propaganda, and manipulation. But as we've seen, Western beliefs about Russians were, if anything, more brutal than Russian views on Westerners. So to some extent, bourgeois propaganda in the West was more successful than its Soviet equivalent. And all this disguised the real conflict in society, which wasn't between the majority of people in Britain, America, the Soviet Union, or anywhere else. The Cold War was between rival sections of the ruling class, and wasn't fought in the interests of the rest of us. So our fight shouldn't have been, and shouldn't be, against other workers, but against the class system. Thank you.